Welcome to the Nation of Writers podcast, presented in conjunction with our exhibit, American Voices, which you can explore in person or online at nationofwriters.org. In this episode, we discuss the life and work of poet and novelist James Welch. Part Blackfeet and part Grovant, Welch grew up on the Blackfeet and Fort Belknap reservations in Montana and graduated from the University of Montana, where he studied writing under poet Richard Hugo. Welch was the author of the novels Winter in the Blood, The Death of Jim Looney, Fool's Crow, for which he received the Los Angeles Times Book Prize, an American Book Award, and the Pacific Northwest Booksellers Award, The Indian Lawyer, and The Heart Song of Charging Elk. Welch also wrote a nonfiction book, Killing Custer, The Battle of the Little Bighorn and the Fate of the Plains Indians, and a work of poetry, Riding the Earth Boy 40. Themes of identity and conflict reverberate throughout Welch's work. In the novel Fool's Crow, published in 1986, set during the 1870s, a young Blackfeet debates assimilation to white culture. Welch, wrote Don Lee in Plowshares, made it his life's work to illuminate the richness of his culture and the heartache of its dislocation. For this episode, we are joined by New York Times bestselling novelist Stephen Graham Jones, most recently the author of I Was a Teenage Slasher. You can read more about Stephen in the episode description. Stephen is interviewed by Nate King, digital content associate at the American Writers Museum. This conversation originally took place November 15th, 2024, and was recorded over Zoom.
Well, thank you, Stephen, for joining me today on this episode of Nation of Writers. I look forward to talking about poet-novelist James Welch with you and his legacy and impact on your life and career as well. Before we get into that, could you tell us a little bit about yourself and what you've been up to recently?
Oh, recently? Man, I've had a few books out. Most recent is I Was a Teenage Slasher. Before that, it was the Indian Lake Trilogy and The Babysitter Lives, which is also coming out. It was an audiobook. It comes out in paper next year. Before that, it was The Only Good Indians and Night of the Mannequins. Before that, Mongrels, Map in the Interior, and then 20-odd books before that as well. A lot of books, a lot of horror.
Yeah, a great auvoir so far. Thank you. Come, I'm sure.
Yeah.
So, we're here to talk about James Welch. And I'm curious do you remember the first time you encountered his work?
I think it was probably when I was working on my master's at North Texas. This would have been about 1995. And I'm not sure which professor told me to read Winter in the Blood, but I believe that is when I read it. And what I felt immediately was that I was already behind. This book had been around since 74. I mean, since I was 2 years old, I probably wouldn't have read it in elementary, but I still could have read it in high school or at least in my undergrad year. So I don't know how I had avoided it, but somehow I did. Really, I think the way I avoided it, it wasn't because I was avoiding Winter in the Blood or James Welch specifically. It was that I felt like a lot of the indigenous fiction I was reading in the, early mid 90s, I felt like it was, it didn't feel authentic to me. And so not like this is Indian, this is not Indian, but like something about something felt off. And I still fail to identify exactly what it was. And it was probably more on my part than the works part, yeah. I think I was just like, I was paranoid about something. I'm not even sure what I was paranoid about, but I spent 2 or 3 years not reading indigenous stuff. And I mean, writing it myself, of course, but maybe I was just trying to make room for myself. Like who's that dude who says you have to make shoulder room, the anxiety of influence kind of stuff? It could have been that.
Yeah. Interesting.
Yeah. But the first time I read it, I was of course blown away. And what really impressed me about Winter in the Blood was how you could have as much absurdity as he has in that novel while not really having a plot to hang it all on. It moves. I mean, maybe it moves like a poem more associationally. I'm not sure, but it doesn't move like most novels move.
Yeah. Yeah. And I found that that you mentioned of the poetry in a lot of interviews with Welch and other retrospectives on him with the mentioned the, he's a poet and novelist, but the bringing the sort of sensibility of a poet into the novel sphere. Really does and resonate and has that. Yeah. The absurdity. I'm glad you used that word. The kind of that I think lends itself to poetry.
It does, definitely. And I think as his career goes on, and I mean, he gets a lot of momentum as a fiction writer. I like Winter in the Blood to me is very non-plot driven, but as the books accumulate, they get more and more plot driven, it feels like, you know? And that's good. I think that's natural. You know, he's figuring out how a novel works, you know? And also he didn't need to figure out how a novel works because he could already do it pretty good.
In your own writing, have you found a similar, maybe not necessarily from poetry to prose, similar growth in your own writing?
You know, I find changes anyways. I always hesitate to call it actual improvement or growth, you know, but I find that I have different sets of muscles and different like moments, you know, and I look back at what I used to do and I wish I could still do that kind of stuff. I wish I still had the nerve to launch off the end of a sentence into another sentence that really should be a paragraph break, but it's actually in jammed inside the paragraph. And I don't know, I used to be able to do things that I can't do anymore. And, you know, I actually spent a while trying to write like James Welch, but I figured out really quickly that he has something that I'll never have. And so I just had to do my own thing, you know?
Could you talk a little bit more about that? We're trying to write like him and then realizing
Yeah.
got
Well,
some.
what I was trying to do was kind of imitate Winter in the Blood, basically. And so I kind of wanted a disaffected, like my protagonists were all these disaffected, you know, 20 something dudes who were, you know, they just processed out after 3 years serving time, or, you know, they were all in some sort of bad condition. Because when I think when you're in your early 20s, you think the secret to telling good stories is make your hero, your protagonist, your main character be, kind of already back on their heels and super tough and all that. You know, you just want to, I don't know, you want them all to be like a the truck stop blanket version of a mythologized biker, you know? And I was kind of in that mode. And that's not what Welch was doing, of course, but that's what I thought I should do. And I was trying to plug that kind of stuff into his stories, which into Winter in the Blood anyways, and Death of Jim Loney, which were the two I had read at the time. And I wanted to try to just string moments together on a and have the reader walk along those moments and provide their own narrative thread. But what I found really quickly was I need a plot. I need dominoes falling and tapping into each other. I need A, B, C, D, E, F, G. And I can't do it any other way. I have to have, for me, the plot comes first and character expresses itself out of plot, you know? And I don't know how James Welch did what he did. But I did figure out after probably 1.5, 2 years of trying that I'm no James Welch anyways.
That I feel like that is a common arc for a writer to kind of try to emulate the ones you like at first, and then you find your own voice through that process.
That's exactly how it goes. Yeah, you think I'm gonna be a lot of people say I'm going to be Raymond Carver, you know, but now people might say I'm going to be George Saunders or something. And yeah, you put on, you like dress, you dress yourself up like that. You zip into a costume and you're like, all right, I'm doing it, but you're not doing it, you know? Like none of us, you can't be Donald Barthelme. There's only one Donald Barthelme, you know?
So maybe now's a good time to talk a little bit about James Welch's biography. He was born and raised on reservations in Montana, the Blackfeet Reservation and Fort Belknap. And so and both his parents were of indigenous background. And so I'm curious if that or how does that upbringing show up in his writing, in your opinion?
Oh, I mean, it can't help. I think we all write from who, like, from the space of who we are, you know? And like, people always ask me, is this like of my work? They'll say, is this an Indian story? Is that an Indian story? I mean, they're all Indian stories. I wrote them. They can't not be Indian stories, you know? They're informed by who I am, how the world's treated me, how I've treated the world, everything. And yeah, it's all just balled up into a single package. You can't tease stuff apart, you know? I do think with James Welch that we all focus on the Blackfeet parts of his writing rather than the Gros-Ventre parts very much, you know? And I'm not sure why that is. I mean, he was on the rolls with the Blackfeet, of course. Maybe that's why. I don't know, but yeah, he just can't, you can't help but write from the place of who and where you are. And he never stopped doing that, even when he was doing the Heart Song of Charging Elf, which is over in Europe, you know?
Yeah, and I in one interview, I maybe a couple actually with him, he mentioned his professor Richard Hugo, the poet Richard Hugo, as being a major inspiration. And before Welsh really took writing seriously, he thought like, no one who would want to know about the Indian stories in Montana. But Hugo was like, well, just try it. And then it turns out, yeah, a lot of people and helped his writing because he, yeah, like you said, he's familiar with that. And yeah, all of the lore passed down through the generations as well, the storytelling, just ingrained in him. So.
No, you're totally right. It's funny. I think, this is before I actually read Winter in the Blood. I was already reading Richard Hugo's Triggering Town, that craft book on poetry he wrote. Probably it's only like 80 pages, 100 pages. And of all the craft books I've read on writing, that's the one that's helped me the most with fiction, because the precepts and principles that he kind of gives about poetry, they all apply to fiction, and I've tried to incorporate them all, and I always fall back on them whenever I'm at some sort of juncture in a project that I can't figure out how to navigate past. I'll kind of fall back on Triggering Town, and it always helps me, so I wish I could say that I knew that Walt studied with Hugo, therefore I tried to learn at Hugo's feet in some sense as well, but it was just more happenstance, it's just that he wrote a really good book on how to write stuff, and I fell into it wholeheartedly,
I'll have to add that one to my list as well. So thank you for that.
It's really solid. And I always hear this. I've never tracked it down, that with Winter in the Blood, this could just be more like urban legend that we, that writers pass from person to person. But I always hear that James Welch was kind of, when he wanted to write a novel, but he couldn't figure out how to conceptualize it, how to keep it all in his head at once. How do you keep 300 pages and multiple characters and all these little plot threads? How do you keep that in mind? And then he went to William Kittredge, and this could be where I'm messing up. He could have gone to Richard Hugo, but it doesn't make as much sense to go to Hugo as Kittredge for this. And he said, "How do you do it? How do you write a novel? I can't keep it all in my head." And Kittredge is supposed to have said, "You don't have to. Just write a lot of scenes and put them all in a single, put them in page numbered sequence of some sort. The reader is gonna call it a novel. You don't have to think of everything at once, And that's kind of what liberated him to do Winter in the Blood, as he did Winter in the Blood, Because, like I was saying, there's no strong plot thread. I mean, yeah, the narrator is looking for his rifle and his razor and all that. But I mean, maybe you could probably argue it's a quest narrative, but it'd be kind of a reach to say that. It's not a quest narrative in the way that Lord of the Rings is a quest narrative, But saying that you just have to write scenes all with the same character, basically, that I think that was it. Who knows if it's true or not, but that feels like it could have been a liberating thing,
Yeah, totally. And a good reminder to trust the reader also. And
Just last night, in preparation for this podcast, I have an old tape of James Welch from 1993, him doing some event. I don't even know what school he's at. And he's up at the front of the room, and it was really cool to watch it last night, because he in 1993 was the same age I am now, And it was neat to, I don't know, have to just to see him there at the front of the room answering all these questions, fielding very tactfully fielding what seemed to me like halfway insulting questions,
I don't think I saw the same one, but it, many interviews with them, the tactfulness and the sort of geniality as well. And I thought, because there were some where the interviewer I was like, ooh, you're asking that question
I
framed that
know.
way? Yeah.
I know. Yeah, like in this one I was watching, someone was asking. They were basically saying it's good that Sundance was outlawed because it's so brutal. And what do you think about that? And just weird stuff like that,
The assumptions made with it,
But he was so, you're right, genial is a really good word for it. He never seems to, maybe he was like mad inside or mad later, or insulted, but he never let it show. And that's really a model to remember to take,
yeah, for sure, yeah. Earlier on, you mentioned how you came to Winter in the Blood a little bit late, you said, as But and yet it still impacted you whenever you read it. So I'm curious what about his writing lasts that stands the test of time that makes it so impactful, no matter when or who picks it up to read it.
Yeah, that's a. I mean, we could ask that of anything. I know, of course, but specifically about Welch, what makes it have lasting impact? You know, it could be. You were talking about how Hugo told Welch, "You can write about your own life. That will be interesting," or you know, some version of that. And I think when I read Winter in the Blood, I thought, "Oh, I mean, because I knew the reservation, of course, and of course, I know what it's like to be Blackfeet," and it kind of told me I can just talk about the small things because I think in my stories up to that point, I had been trying to deal with like, I don't know, identity politics and all this like this stuff we get taught in the classroom, which isn't bad stuff, but it doesn't really lend itself to I don't know, story necessarily. You know, it kind of lends itself to giving you check boxes of things to talk about in a story. And I don't think James Welch was interested in that. He didn't seem to have like a agenda necessarily. He was just interested in these characters in this moment, you know? And I think that's what I take from Winter in the Blood and probably from all of his writing is don't let things get cluttered up, you know. Just engage these characters in a real place, follow them around, be honest with what they're doing and why they're doing it, and you might luck into something good.
Yeah, that's a great point. And I've been reading Fool's Crow, as I said in the previous emails, and in the introduction to the copy I have, it's by Thomas McGuane.
Yeah, I've read that, yeah.
Yeah, and he mentions that Welch spends no time trying to explain what the native terms are in relation to today's terms. And I And he in the introduction even mentioned something like he might need a little he might feel like you need a translation, but just go along with it, and then it doesn't and it and to your point of like again of trusting the reader, it's like this is the story, and don't you don't need a glossary or any sort of thing to because it all comes through, and it's those little things that make the story, and sometimes it's those little things that tell the truth that say nonfiction can't.
No, I totally agree. And yeah, the first time I read Fool's Crow, I think I spent the whole book not knowing what a sticky mouth was, you know? And I don't know how I figured it out finally, but I finally did. And you know, I'm not here to hype my own stuff, but I did recently reread Fool's Crow as, I mean, number one, for pleasure, because it's a great book, but number two, kind of for research, because I wrote a novel set back from 1870 to 1884. And so I needed to understand the mode of thinking and also nab a lot of vocabulary. And I had to, you know, ask friends on the reservation for a lot of help with more vocabulary. But yeah, you're right. A gloss like a Clockwork Orange kind of glossary in Fool's Crow would just serve to signal to the wider audience, the non-Blackfeet audience, that this is exotic, this is neat. You should come here and look at this shiny thing that you haven't seen before. And I don't think that's how he wanted his work positioned.
Yeah, right. And that makes me think a little bit, in my research, he's been noted as a major figure in the Native American Renaissance of the late 60s, 70s. I'm curious how you think about that, and perhaps what do you think he would have, would he agree with that assessment or what?
Yeah, I think he would. I mean, I've heard him in questions and answers. People always ask him something about the Native American Renaissance, and he's like, "Yeah, we were all doing this, and more or less." And he'll kind of, you know, identify that pattern. You've probably come across that article of what the homing pattern in Native American novel is. That I think is what it's called. I want to say it's by William Bevis, something like that. I could be wrong, but it talks about kind of how Housemaid of Dawn set the template of a main character who has been disenfranchised from his community and has to work in circles to spiral back in to come home, you know, and that's what a lot of the Native American Renaissance novels are characterized by. There were people who broke that mold too. Like I think Louise Erdrich probably broke that mold pretty effectively, and Vizner was interested in blowing everything up in a wonderful way, you know. But I do think that Winter in the Blood does Not intentionally, but it does fall into that House Made of Dawn pattern a little bit, you know, which isn't bad. It's good, and I actually prefer the way it's done in Winter in the Blood as to how it's done in House Made of Dawn, you know. But yeah, I mean, Mamadé with by winning the Pulitzer in what 69, I guess, for the 68 novel. He kicked open the doors in a really good way, and. And we can't forget that this was the late 60s, the civil rights era, you know, and a lot of Native authors were able to not be like at the center of things, but they were able to get into the room through that door that Mamadé kicked open anyways. And Welch is one of those people. And he, I guess, is Winter in the Blood the first big Native novel after Housemaid of Dawn? It might be because Storyteller was a little after, Ceremony was a little after, Visitor's Monkey King in China was a little after, and then Love Medicine wasn't until the early 80s. Yeah, it might be the first big one to get a lot of attention. And but I never like with the Native American Renaissance, number one, like Renaissance is that's basically rebirth, right? Isn't that what the word means? And like it's a that term always confuses me a little bit because what is it, a rebirth of like the Darcy McNicol era, the Mourning Dove era? I don't know. You know, I don't know what it's what's the what that what the idea is. But nevertheless, something was cooking, you know, and these writers were all putting good books on the shelves. And, but I don't think that they were, they had like a Discord where they're talking about, we're going to do this, we're going to do that. You know, I think they were just all writing books, and either the critical establishment wanted to find similarities among those books so they could identify a movement, you know, but, and the books do have some similarities, but I think of everybody who was working in what we call the Native American Renaissance, James Welch being one of the, you know, the leaders of that, I don't think he was necessarily subscribed to the to like we're all a movable feast, we're all doing this together, you know. I think he was just doing his own thing, and it just happened to fall in line with what other people were doing.
And the term Renaissance also I've always been curious about because it's almost more of like a re-noticing of it, like not on the audience's side, but
But it's good marketing. Renaissance is a fun word to say.
It packages it up nicely.
And I mean, but also, where does it stop? You know, does it stop when Alexei comes on the scene? I'm not sure where it actually stops. It may stop. I mean, probably the legitimate way to find a stop point is when the work quit cohering as a single unit. You know, when it started to branch out into a lot of different variations, that's probably when it becomes something else.
Have you ever taught Welch in any courses?
I've taught, let's see, I think Winter in the Blood, I've taught it probably three times, four times. Yeah, most recently, I taught it up at University of Montana at the same program he taught in, you know. And it was really cool because, you know, some of the people around there still have stories about him just sitting in his office smoking 3,000 cigarettes at a time, you know, and everything. And nobody ever, I've never heard anyone say a single bad thing about Welch. Like usually when you're traveling in writer circles, people will build somebody up, but then there's always like, they want to take a little chip out, you know, they want to say something negative. And I've never heard a single bad thing about James Welch. And that is speaks really well of him, I think. And, you know, when I was at Montana, I got to be the, what, James Welch, Native American visiting
I
professor,
think
something
it's
like, yeah, is that
I
it?
think I, it's the James and Lois Welch Distinguished Native American Visiting Writer.
That's it. I can't believe I left Lois out. That's so terrible. I got to hang out with her when I was up there. I never got to meet James Welch. I'm so honored to now know Lois Welch. And in that, you know, that VHS tape I was watching last night of that 1993 event he did for Fool, not for Fool's Crow, but I think this was actually post Indian Lawyer, but Fool's Crow was the book he was talking about at this event. He mentions sitting at his writing desk for 4 hours trying to come up with a single sentence, which we all do, you know. And but I've sat at that desk. Lois let me sit at that desk, you know, which is so cool. And yeah, Lois is so cool. She's amazing to know. She's so intelligent, so smart, so with it. And yeah, I mean, I wish I'd got to meet James, but I'm thrilled to know Lois.
And there's a certain magic or feeling by seeing the desk where,
Oh, and also, Lois, I'm at we I did this big reading at the museum there in Missoula, and she gave me a little, it's kind of like a neon circle sign with a, it has a circle and it says super kind of like superhero style across the middle of it. She said that hung above James Welch's desk for 30 years, and she thought it was time for it to hang above my desk. And so I've got it right above my desk now, which is that's like the high, I can't imagine a higher honor than that, you know?
Wow, yeah, that's very
Yeah.
cool.
Yeah.
And going back to teaching, what are some responses that students have had in modern times in encountering his
You
work?
know, the moment, or not the moment, the little like narrative thread that gets the most attention in Winter in the Blood with undergraduates, anyways, seems to be the airplane man. You know, everybody wants to know what's up with that dude. You know, is he really there? Is he like a magical figure? What's going on with him? And I never have a good answer because I honestly don't know either what's up with him. But he's very fun to watch. He's so like all his gestures are big, you know. And in a story kind of as muted as Winter in the Blood, I think James Welch recognized we need a loud character, you know, we need an expansive character. And Airplane Man supplies that very well.
That's fascinating about the airplane man and the interest in that among undergrads.
Yeah, I think it's, Airplane Man is interesting, but I think he is just easy to like hook onto and extract from the story and talk about, you know? I like to talk about Mose myself. I think Mose is really interesting, you know, the brother.
Yeah, and another thing in well, I must admit, I watched the film.
Yeah.
Winter in the Blood,
Yeah.
and then also reading Fool's Crow, the humor is evident in the banter. I've really this the enjoyed the teasing aspect of that, and I wonder if you could speak to that a little bit, because I did in another interview, I'll quote Welch right now. It says, "You need to laugh at yourselves. If you take yourselves too seriously, I think you really develop an image that only represents one side of the Indian personality. Indian humor is very incredible." So
Yeah.
yeah, and
No, the humor, and you know, you asked earlier, the first time I read Winter in the Blood, what did I get from it? I think that's probably what I got from it was the humor, was the permission to actually be funny on the page, you know? Because writing programs don't really support comic stuff very well, you know? They want you to be serious and dour, and if it makes somebody laugh, then that's not, you know, we need to do intellectual things, please, you know? Welch did not care about that. He had a good sense of humor, definitely. And I kind of took the humor from Winter in the Blood as my I don't know, threshold or something for, I mean, if something is, I guess, A, good and B, Indian, you know. People are always trying to figure out what makes a novel Indian and what's the like point at which it stops being Indian, and who knows where. I mean, that line is ridiculous to try to figure out because first you have to define Indian, and how in the world do you define that? But my own like litmus test is if I'm reading a piece set on a reservation or wherever, or with an Indian community or Indian characters, and people aren't you know, cracking jokes, being funny, undercutting things with grins and everything, then I know this was probably not written by somebody who knows the community, knows the people, knows the way life is, you know? And which is to say, they treat everything as sacred. And I don't know. I mean, that's the response I despise the most to native literature is, oh, we got to put on our special gloves now because this is really exotic, sacred material, you know? And it's not. It's just stories, and we're just poking fun at things and having a good time, you know?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. There's another that kind of makes me think of another quote of Welch's that I found was in a 1985 interview. He says, "I used to be able to say that I'm an Indian who writes, and I still say that, but more and more my subject matter has been Indians. I seem to be becoming more and more of an Indian writer." And then at the same time, he resisted that categorization and he said, "I think ethnic and regional labels are insulting to writers and really put restrictions on them. People don't think your work is quite as universal."
No, I totally agree. I always feel like anytime you let the critical establishment, the marketplace, whoever put an adjective in front of your name, like Indian or I don't know, splatterpunk or romance or anything, then that adjective in front of your name serves as a handle they can use to lift you up, put you in a little cubby hole, and forget about you. You get rid of you, basically. So I think that That's one thing I learned from Welch. I learned it from Louise Erdrich. I learned it from Jill Lansdale, is resist that categorization with every chance you get, resist it. The only one that I allow that I'm not sad about when I see it in front of my name is New York Times bestseller. I think that's a good one. But the rest of them, I always try to kick. I just want to be a writer. And like Welch, I'm just a writer who happens to be Indian,
And like you said earlier, and then so that's where your stories will stem from, is your life and identity.
Yeah, like my novel Mongrels, it's about werewolves, and it never says Indian once, Native American, Indigenous, any of that. But to me, it's like a super Indian novel,
We've kind of touched on this a little bit, but and maybe in your introducing it to students as well, you already have an answer for this, but why would you recommend people read Welch today? I think for me it would be just as a artist, just understanding the craft. But there's more, I'm sure.
That's my first answer as well. You can learn technique and craft from him. You can learn like how to have a steady hand a little bit by watching people. If you watch people with steady hands, you can learn to have a steady hand yourself, I feel like. And he had a very steady hand. Maybe not while he was writing, and he may have been wilding, he may have been out of control while he's writing, but it looks steady. The result is very, very stable, it feels like, which isn't to say it's not dangerous. It's also dangerous. But why we should read him, I think it's just the reason we read any book. We engage art hoping it can change us and make us see things in a different way and make the world better. And James Welch is an artist, he's a novelist, he's a fiction writer, he's a poet, and engaging his work can tell us things about ourselves, make us feel less alone,
I like how you said, like, why read any book,
Yeah.
and yeah, you might as well read from one of the masters of those stories.
Yeah.
And so
Yeah.
how do you think, if Welch were still with us today, how do you think he'd be engaging, with our current world and all of its ills?
I think well, how are you engaging with the world? That's a good question. I don't think you'd be on Twitter, but I think he would, if he were alive now, he'd be what, 84, I guess, which is to say he has a long view. He has a like a wide he'd have a wide scope of things, and he would understand that what we're seeing today is part of a never-ending cycle, that we all scream and pull our hair and say the world is a trash fire, and he's like, yeah, was it good in 1940, 1950? Was it good in 1960? And he would deliver that in a way that didn't sound like he had authority, because he never was a person to speak from a place of authority. And I think that's good. I'm really suspicious of people who speak with authority. He would catch it in a joke, in a non-confrontational manner, and it would be more effective for that.
Yeah, that's a great point. That kind of makes me, in another interview, the interviewer was asking about specific details about, blanking on the name, the one that takes place in France.
Oh, Heart Song of Charging Elk.
And the interviewer was really wanting to know, like, why didn't you bring Charging Elk back to the States, or what happened? And his answers were, they were making me kind of laugh to myself, because he was like, well, I left it ambiguous on purpose, like I and sort of like let you why don't you figure out why don't you think what happened? And then, like, I like that sort of, like you said, not an authoritative personality, but
We don't like it when writers, when you ask them a question about their book and they're like, oh, it's this way, it's this way, it's ABC, like definite finite answers. They kind of kill the text. They keep it from being a living, breathing thing. And those, particularly those kind of ambiguous endings, as opposed to a vague ending, I think vague endings are kind of the writer having a lack of commitment, or they don't want to risk themselves or something like that, or extend themselves. But yeah, those like ambiguous endings, they ask us to invest in this or that or that, and by us choosing this door for the ending, that door or that door, it tells us something about ourselves. Why do we want door B instead of door A? Yeah, novels, they teach us about ourselves a lot, I think.
Yeah, and like you said, each individual reader will have a different take on it. And
Yeah.
I'm curious also, it's because, like you said, you've reread his work. That's one thing I found in rereading a work is, I'm a different person when I come back to it. And so I'm curious if you've had any different experiences in the times you've reread his work.
Yeah, I do. Like I think this last time I read Fool's Crow, I think it's because I was reading it in a different way. Before, I probably read it twice before, and both times I read it before, it was just for pleasure because I wanted to read a good book. This
Yeah.
time I got that from it, but I also was able, I mean, who knows how successful, but I was able to somewhat extract or engage myself the type of thinking that was operant for the Blackfeet in the late 19th century, which is wildly different from the way we think now. Largely, I'm not saying that for that's for everyone. Definitely, it's that way for me. It made me understand the mountain he had to climb to write this book. He had to basically shift his brain and become somebody else, and that's what we all do when we write a book. But Fool's Crow took a lot more brain twisting, I feel like, than a lot of books do.
Yeah, that's a good point. And like, especially going back in time that far. Um,
Yeah, well, it's a, yeah, I think it, yeah, it's like, I think it starts in 1869. So, yeah,
yeah.
100, 150 years, anyways.
Yeah. Yeah, right. Yeah. I did want to ask about the poetry a little bit. Are you familiar with with Welch's poetry?
I've read Riding the Earth Boy 40. It's been probably 15 years, maybe 2 decades. But yeah, no, I like the spareness of his poetry, and I like, most of his poems seem to fit on a single page, it feels like, too. And I kind of, that's kind of attractive to me. And I don't know why. I don't know why necessarily, but maybe it's because I have the illusion I can memorize them or something. I don't know. But some of his poems are really little, and I like that. It's kind of, it makes me think of, I mean, it's the same size as that old, who is that? It's all about the red rooster sitting on the wagon or wheelbarrow, whatever that famous old poem is. And every time I read Welch's poetry, I'm put in the place of that poem, or maybe that poem puts me in the place of Welch's poetry. They seem to be in dialogue with each other to me. The smallness, the it's not condensed. It's not like a neutron star. It's not like super compact or anything. It's just spare. That's the only word I would use for his poetry is spare, I think. And that, but that spareness is very like the Highland country that he, always wrote about, up in, going across the top of Montana. And it's got that same spare quality. It's weird to me to compare poetry to a landscape, but I feel like James Welch's poetry is very much in keeping with that landscape.
Right, yeah. Like you said, it's weird, but also a testament to the writing of it itself. Yeah, that it can evoke a physical place, which is impressive.
Yeah, it's neat how, I mean, and all poets do this, I'm sure, not just James Welch, and I don't have any idea what this is like because I write 500-page books, but to take like a huge feeling and pare it down to like 48 words, that, I just don't know how you do that. That blows my mind.
Yeah, agreed. Yes. It does make me think. In another interview with him, he was talking about his writing in high school. He was as a high schooler, he was writing poetry, but he called it like it's something like, yeah, I was writing like cheerleader love poems and like that sort of stuff. And he didn't think it was any good, but
That's my first writing too. It was
yeah.
like these long metaphorical notes to girls,
Yeah.
like two swans on a pond in the moonlight and their necks entwined, all that stupid stuff.
Yeah, but at least it gets it gets you interested in writing at least. Yeah.
No, but not only that, but it kind of conditions you to the pragmatic uses of writing,
True. Yeah. So I think we kind of covered this one already, but including yourself, but at the sort of literary lineage of James Welch, is it almost, many novelists today, like indigenous or
Yeah,
otherwise,
I mean,
go.
I wouldn't put myself first and foremost, but I do think he's been a huge influence on me. But I would hesitate to say he handed me a torch and I took off with it. I think that's a big claim. I don't think that's the case at all. But if you know Sterling Holywhite Mountain's work, he's doing really good work. Sterling is he's a Blackfeet dude,
Okay.
and he's like he's had multiple pieces in the New Yorker and I don't know, Paris Review. He's really making a good name for himself, and he's just a really good writer. And he's got that same, when he wants, he's got that same spareness that James Welch had, you know. And I think it probably is because Sterling grew up there, you know. I didn't grow up there. I grew up in Texas, so I'll have different things in my writing that I can't ever scrub out, you know, and I guess why would I want to either. But no, Sterling is somebody I would say is definitely in James Welch's, like, I don't know if, yeah, lineage or influence sphere, whatever you want to call it, you know.
Well, that's great. Another one I'll have to add to my
Yeah.
reading list, my ever-growing reading list.
Yeah.
As we're getting close to wrapping up here, was there anything else that you wanted to touch on that we haven't covered yet about Welch or your own relation to him?
You know, I like all of his books. My favorite, I don't know, it's a hard pick for me between Winter in the Blood and Fool's Grove. I don't know, I might land on Winter in the Blood, I guess. Maybe just because I read it first, so it's closer to my heart a little bit. But his ending for Indian Lawyer, I think that's his best ending. And it's just a guy at a ready basketball goal shooting free throws, you know? And I feel like that image, that moment is kind of what I maybe built one of my novels around, The Only Good Indians. You know, it's a basketball horror novel. And I say it's a basketball horror novel like there's 8,000 of them. It may be the only one. It's the only one I know of anyways. But yeah, that image, I think I spent, I guess I mean, when did that novel come out? Like 90 or somewhere around there, it seems like.
90.
When was it?
1990.
1990. Okay, I got it the first time. That's the year I graduated high school. I didn't read it that year. I read it after I read Winter in the Blood. But that end, the way he ends that, not on a plot thread, but on an image, and he holds on that image. He doesn't like romanticize it either. I use that as a model in my writing for a long time, and I think it's still there too, you know. Actually, I didn't think about it. I have a novel out in March, which to me, I don't know if it's in dialogue with that ending, but I can see that ending's influence in this Buffalo Hunter Hunter ending anyways.
That's great. That led me into my next question, which is what's up next for you? So it's March, you said?
Yeah, March 18th, The Buffalo Hunter Hunter. It's a novel. It starts in 2012 with an old diary is found in the wall of a parsonage in Miles City, Montana. A professor starts reading it, and it's the diary left behind by a Lutheran pastor in Miles City a century ago. And the story he tells is of after his church service one day, everyone left except for one guy way in the back, this Blackfeet dude in a robe and black glasses. And he starts telling what he calls his confession to this pastor over multiple Sundays. And his story is about revenge, about maybe being a vampire, about coming at the buffalo hunters who, you know, wiped out the herds, about coming at the people who perpetrated the massacre against the Blackfeet in 1870. And yeah, it was super, super fun to write. Of all the novels I've written, it's probably the second most difficult one I've done, I think. But it was worth it to me. I liked it.
Well, I certainly look forward to that.
Thank you. Thank you.
Well, yeah, thank you, Stephen, for joining me
Yeah.
today. I had a blast and
Thank
learned
you,
a
man. This
lot.
was
So,
fun. Yeah, so, I always like talking about Welch, you know.
thanks again, Stephen, and
Yeah.
have a great day.
Take it easy, man.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Nation of Writers podcast, part of the American Writers Museum podcast network. If you would like to learn more about American writers and their impact on our history, our culture, and our daily lives, find us online or come see us in person. The American Writers Museum is open Thursdays through Mondays from 10 a.m. to 5 p.m., only closed on Tuesdays and Wednesdays. Once again, thank you for listening, and to all you writers out there, thank you for writing.